Chapter 15, Property Management and AMP, Leasing the Management Profession. Most metropolitan areas have local associations of building and property owners and managers that are affiliates of regional and national associations. All of these professional organizations provide information and contacts for all aspects of property management. Here is a list of some well-known associations. Building Owners and Managers Association International, BOMA Commercial Real Estate. Building Owners and Managers Institute International, BOMI Education Programs for Commercial Property and Facility Management Industries. Community Associations Institute, CI Homeowners Associations, Condominiums, and Other Planned Communities. Institute of Real Estate Management, IREM Multifamily and Commercial Real Estate Designation. International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC Shopping Centers Worldwide. National Apartment Association, NAH, Multifamily Housing Industry. National Association of Home Builders, NAB, all aspects of home building. National Association of Residential Property Managers, NARPM, single family and small residential properties. The Property Manager. In addition to leasing, managing, marketing, and overall maintenance of real estate owned by others, it is also expected that a property manager function as a market analyst, residential leasing agent, accountant, advertising specialist, and maintenance person all in the same day. In addition, the property manager frequently interacts with people in various professions, including lawyers, environmental engineers, and accountants. The property manager has three principal responsibilities. Achieve the objectives of the property owners. Generate income for the owners. Preserve and/or increase the value of the investment property. Some property managers work for property management companies. These firms manage properties for a number of owners under management agreements, discussed later. Other property managers are independent. The property manager has an agency relationship with the owner, which involves greater authority and discretion over management decisions than an employee would have. Illinois property managers must be licensed managing brokers under a sponsoring broker because they engage in collecting rent, negotiating leases and rentals, and procuring tenants, among other functions. However, the Illinois Real Estate License Act of 2000 specifically exempts resident managers of apartment buildings, duplexes, and apartment complexes from licensure requirements when their primary residence is on the premises being managed. Illinois permits individuals whose real estate practice is limited to leasing or renting residential property, collecting rent, negotiating leases, and similar activities to obtain a residential leasing agent license instead of the broader scope broker or managing broker license. An individual with a residential leasing agent license must be sponsored by a sponsoring broker. Securing management business. Possible sources of a property management business include corporate owners, apartment buildings, owners of small rental residential properties, homeowners associations, investment syndicates, trusts, and owners of office buildings. Property managers' responsibilities: financial reports. One of the primary responsibilities of a property manager is maintaining financial reports, including an operating budget, cash flow report, profit and loss statement, and budget comparison statement. Operating budget. An operating budget is the projection of income and expense for the operation of a property over a one-year period. This budget, developed before attempting to rent property, is based on anticipated revenues and expenses and provides the owner the amount of anticipated profit. The property manager and owner use the operating budget as a guide for the property's financial performance in the present and future. Income. Income includes gross rentals collected, delinquent rental payments, utilities, vending contracts, late fees, and storage charges. Any losses from uncollected rental payments or evictions are deducted from the total gross to arrive at the total adjusted income. Expenses. Fixed and variable expenses include administrative costs, including building personnel, operating expenses, and maintenance costs. Fixed expenses that remain constant and do not change include employee wages, utilities, and other basic operating costs. Variable expenses may be recurring or non-recurring and can include capital improvements, building repairs, and landscaping. Cash flow report. A cash flow report is a monthly statement that details the financial status of the property, Sources of income and expenses are noted, as well as net operating income and net cash flow. The cash flow report is the most important financial report because it provides a picture of the current financial status of a property. The formula for arriving at cash flow is as follows. Gross rental income plus other income less losses incurred equals total income. Total income less operating expenses equals net operating income before debt service, example mortgage payments. Net operating income before debt service less reserves equals cash flow profit and loss statement. This is a financial picture of the revenues and expenses used to determine whether the business has made money or suffered a loss. The statement is created from the monthly cash flow reports and does not include itemized information. A formula for profit and loss statement looks like this: gross receipts, minus expenses, minus total mortgage payments, which includes principal and interest, equals net profits. Budget comparison statement. The budget comparison statement compares the actual results with the original budget, often giving either percentages or a numerical variance of actual versus projected income and expenses. New opportunities. Community association management. The prevalence of homeowners and condominium associations, combined with complex planning and development codes, have placed new demands on property managers. Working as part of a team, property managers assist in providing a comprehensive array of services to volunteer boards. The Illinois Community Association Manager Licensing and Disciplinary Act was created to provide for the regulation of managers of community associations. To ensure that managers are qualified to engage in community association management. To provide for high standards of professional conduct by those licensed. Anyone acting under this license cannot perform any activities for which a real estate broker's license is required, under the Illinois Real Estate License Act of 2000. Resort housing. Managing second home and resort rentals presents specific challenges. These managers must be able to care for and maintain often vacant properties and be able to attract and manage short-term tenants. Housing for the near elderly and elderly. Opportunities abound in managing housing for the near elderly and elderly, many of which are federally assisted housing programs. Since subsidized housing is involved, these property managers need to be familiar with state and federal rules pertaining to eligibility requirements and income verification. Manufactured homes. Homes built in factories meeting HUD specifications are called manufactured homes, incorrectly, mobile homes. These homes are permanently attached to concrete pads or foundations. They can be placed on individual lots or in manufactured home communities. They are taxed as real estate. Mobile homes. These homes are designed to be towed from place to place, and as a result consist of lighter construction which does not age well. Some mobile homes are located in mobile home parks or communities and are not moved once they are placed on a lot. They are normally not permanently attached to the land and as such, are taxed as personal property. The majority of these lots are rented, day, week, month, year, but some are purchased by the mobile homeowner. Concierge services. A new area for property managers to specialize in is the training and managing of concierge staff for office buildings and other settings. Concierge staff is responsible for anything from arranging for taxi rides to assisting with visual aid equipment for a conference. Asset management. Asset managers monitor a portfolio of properties similar to a securities portfolio by analyzing the performance of the properties and making recommendations to the owners of the properties. Real property asset management helps clients decide what type of real estate to invest in, commercial or residential, which property is best to purchase, the best financial sources for a real estate purchase, and when to dispose of property. Corporate property managers. Corporate property managers manage properties for corporations that invest in real estate or medium and large-sized companies that have a large number of real estate properties for corporate operations. Typically, corporate property managers are employees of the corporation and not independent contractors. Residential leasing agents. Residential leasing agents are usually independent contractors working for a sponsoring broker on a commission basis, and are in high demand because of their skill in securing lessees. The management plan and agreement. The management plan. Property management begins with a management plan prepared by the property manager. A management plan outlines the details of the owner's objectives with the property, as well as what the property manager expects to accomplish and how, including all financial objectives. In preparing a management plan, a property manager analyzes three factors. The owner's objectives. The regional and neighborhood market. The specific property. Occupancy, absorption rates, and new starts are critical indicators. The plan also includes a budgetary section on sources of revenue and anticipated expenses. The management agreement. The first step in taking over the management of any property is to enter into a management agreement with the owner. This agreement creates a general agency relationship between the owner and the property manager. It defines the duties and responsibilities of each party. It is also a guide used in operating the property as well as a reference in case of future disputes. Like any other contract involving real estate, the management agreement should be in writing. It should include the following. Description of the property. This should include the street address of the property as well as the legal description. Time period the agreement covers. This would include specific provisions for termination. Definition of the management's responsibilities. All the manager's duties should be specifically stated in the contract. Any limitations or restrictions on what the manager may do should be included. Statement of the owner's purpose. The owner should clearly state what the manager is to accomplish. One owner may want to maximize net income, while another will want to increase the capital value of the investment. Long-term goals are often key. Extent of the manager's authority. This provision should state what authority the manager is to have in matters such as hiring, firing, and supervising employees, fixing rental rates for space, and making expenditures and authorizing repairs. Repairs that exceed a certain expense limit may require the owner's written approval. Reporting. The frequency and detail of the manager's periodic reports on operations and financial position should be agreed on. These reports serve as a means for the owner to monitor the manager's work and operational trends. They form a basis for shaping management policy. Management fee. The fee may be based on a percentage of gross or net income, a fixed fee, or some combination of these and other factors. The fee must be negotiated between the property manager and the principal. In addition, the property manager may be entitled to a commission on new rentals and renewed leases. Allocation of costs. The agreement should state which of the property manager's expenses, such as office rent, office help, telephone, advertising, and association fees, will be paid by the manager. Other costs will be paid by the owner. Antitrust provisions. Management fees are subject to the same antitrust considerations as sales commissions. Equal opportunity statement. Residential property management agreements should include a statement that the property will be shown, rented, and otherwise made available to all persons protected by state or federal law. Renting the property. Setting rental rates. Rental rates are influenced primarily by supply and demand. The property manager should conduct a detailed survey of the competitive space available in the neighborhood, emphasizing similar properties. In establishing rental rates, the property manager has four long-term considerations. The rental income must be sufficient to cover the property's fixed charges and operating expenses. The rental income must provide a fair return on the owner's investment. The rental rate should be in line with prevailing rates in comparable buildings in the area. It may be slightly higher or slightly lower, depending on the strength of the property. The current vacancy rate in the property is a good indicator of how much of a rent increase is advisable. A building with a low vacancy rate is a better candidate for an increase than one with a high vacancy rate. A rental rate for residential space is usually stated as the monthly rate per unit. Commercial leases, including office, retail, and industrial space rentals, are usually stated according to annual rates per square foot. An elevated level of vacancy may indicate poor management or a defective or an undesirable property. On the other hand, a high occupancy rate may mean that rental rates are too low. Collecting rents. A property manager should accept only those tenants who can be expected to meet their financial obligations. In addition to contacting credit bureaus, the selection process involves calling financial references and, if possible, interviewing the former landlord. Eviction history is now also checked. The terms of rental payment should be spelled out in the lease agreement, including time and place of payment, provisions and penalties for late payment and return checks, and provisions for cancellation and damages in case of non-payment. The property manager should establish a firm and consistent collection plan. The plan should include a system of notices and records that complies with state and local law. Every attempt must be made to collect rent without resorting to legal action. Legal action is costly and time-consuming and does not contribute to good tenant relations. When it is unavoidable, legal action must be taken in cooperation with the property owner's or management firm's legal counsel. In Illinois, specific legal procedures must be followed in taking legal action against a tenant. In addition, Illinois law has specific provisions regarding the maintenance and payment of interest on security deposits. Property managers, who must have broker or managing broker licenses, must put security deposits in a special escrow account, in the same way that real estate licensees must handle earnest money. The security deposits must be deposited in the escrow account by the next business day after a lease is signed, and this must be recorded in the journal and ledger. This escrow account is a non-interest-bearing account unless the property is residential with 25 or more units, in which case interest must be paid to the tenants. Maintaining good relations with tenants and effective property manager establishes a good communication system with tenants. Regular newsletters or posted memoranda help keep tenants informed and involved. Maintenance and service requests must be attended to promptly, and all lease terms and building rules must be enforced consistently and fairly. The property manager must be able to handle residents who do not pay their rents on time or who break building regulations. Careful record keeping shows whether rent is remitted promptly and in the proper amount. Records of all lease renewal dates should be kept so that the manager can anticipate expiration and retain good tenants who otherwise might move when their leases end. Maintaining the property. One of the most important functions of a property manager is the supervision of property maintenance. A manager must learn to balance services provided with their costs, that is, to satisfy tenants' needs while minimizing operating expenses. To maintain the property efficiently, the manager must be able to assess the building's needs and how best to meet them. In some cases, the best plan may be to operate a low-rental property with minimal expenditures for services and maintenance. Another property may be more lucrative if kept in top condition and operated with all possible tenant services. A well-maintained, high-service property can command premium rental rates. A primary maintenance objective is to protect the physical integrity of the property over the long term. For example, preserving the property by repainting the exterior or replacing the heating system helps decrease long-term maintenance costs. Keeping the property in good condition involves the following four types of maintenance. Preventive maintenance. Repair or corrective maintenance. Routine maintenance. Construction preventive maintenance. This includes regularly scheduled activities such as painting and seasonal servicing of appliances and systems. Preventive maintenance preserves the long-range value and physical integrity of the building. This is both the most critical and the most neglected maintenance responsibility. Failure to perform preventive maintenance invariably leads to greater expense in other areas of maintenance. Repair or corrective maintenance, this involves the actual repairs that keep the building's equipment, utilities, and amenities functioning. Repairing a boiler, fixing a leaky faucet, or mending a broken air conditioning unit are acts of corrective maintenance. Routine maintenance. Routine maintenance includes such day-to-day duties as cleaning common areas, performing minor carpentry and plumbing adjustments, and providing regularly scheduled upkeep of landscaping. Good routine maintenance is similar to good preventive maintenance. Both head off problems before they become expensive. One of the major decisions a property manager faces is whether to contract for maintenance services from an outside firm or hire on-site employees to perform such tasks. This decision should be based on a number of factors, including size of the building, complexity of the tenant's requirements, and availability of suitable labor. Construction. A commercial or an industrial property manager often is called on to make tenant improvements, sometimes referred to as TI. These are alterations to the interior of the building to meet a tenant's particular space needs. Such construction alterations range from simply repainting or recarpeting to completely gutting the interior and redesigning the space by erecting new walls, adding partitions, and revamping electrical systems. In new construction, especially, the interiors are usually left incomplete so that they can be adapted to the needs of individual tenants. One matter that must be clarified is which improvements will be considered trade fixtures, personal property belonging to the tenant, and which will belong to the owner of the real estate. Modernization or renovation of buildings that have become functionally obsolete and thus unsuited to today's building needs is also important. The renovation of a building often enhances marketability and potential income. Handling environmental concerns, managers may manage structures containing asbestos or radon, or be called on to arrange an environmental audit of a property. Managers must see that any hazardous wastes produced by their employees or tenants are properly disposed of. Even non-hazardous waste of an office building must be controlled to avoid violation of laws requiring segregation and recycling of types of wastes. Air quality issues are a key concern for those involved in property management and design. Building-related illnesses, BRI, and sick building syndrome, SBS, are illnesses that are more prevalent today because of energy and efficiency standards used in construction that make buildings more airtight with less ventilation. SBS is more typical in an office building. The Americans with Disabilities ACT Title I of the ADA provides for the employment of qualified job applicants, regardless of their disability. Any employer with 15 or more employees must adopt non-discriminatory employment procedures. In addition, employers must make reasonable accommodations to enable individuals with disabilities to perform essential job functions. Title III of the ADA prohibits discrimination in commercial properties and public accommodations. The ADA requires that managers ensure that people with disabilities have full and equal access to facilities and services. The ADA recommends reasonably achievable accommodations to provide access to the facilities and services. New construction and remodeling, however, must meet higher standards because new design costs less than retrofitting. An unexpected benefit to new owners is that many of the accessible design features and accommodations benefit everyone. Existing barriers must be removed when this can be accomplished in a readily achievable manner, that is, with little difficulty and at low cost. The following are typical examples of readily achievable modifications. Ramping or removing an obstacle from an otherwise accessible entrance. Lowering wall-mounted public telephones. Adding raised letters and braille markings on elevator buttons. Installing auditory signals in elevators. Reversing the direction in which doors open for wheelchair accessibility. Providing doors that have mechanisms that will open and close the doors automatically. Civil rights laws. The Illinois Human Rights Act extends the list of protected classes for Illinois. It states as the public policy of Illinois and purpose of the act, freedom from unlawful discrimination. To secure for all individuals within Illinois the freedom from discrimination against an individual because of his or her race, color, religion, sex, national origin, ancestry, age, marital status, physical or mental disability, familial status, military status, unfavorable discharge from military service, or sexual orientation and order of protection status in connection with employment, real estate transactions, access to financial credit, and the availability of public accommodations. Article 3 of this Act deals with real estate transactions. Lead-based paint. The 1996 Federal Lead-Based Paint Hazard Reduction Act Title X focused more strongly on disclosure and realtor registered liability. This federal law supersedes any state laws that are not as strong. Real estate licensees leasing properties built before 1978 must ensure that landlords disclose any possible lead-based paint or related hazards. This disclosure form must be completed even in the case of an oral lease agreement. Once an offer for lease is received, the licensee representing the lessor, landlord, must make certain a completed disclosure of information from landlord and acknowledgement form from tenant are attached, showing that the disclosure requirements were met. Finally, a federal lead hazard information pamphlet, obtained through the National Lead Information Clearinghouse at 800-424-LEAD-5323, must be distributed before leasing the property. The Illinois Lead Poisoning Prevention Act requires that the owner of any residential building cited by the state as a lead paint hazard give prospective tenants written notice of the danger unless the owners have a certificate of compliance. This act is bolstered in its scope by the federal legislation noted earlier. When a mitigation order is issued to an owner of a building containing lead hazards, the owner has 90 days to eliminate the hazard in a manner prescribed by state law, or 30 days if occupied by a child under age 6 or by a pregnant woman. Risk management. The perils of any risk must be evaluated in terms of options. In considering the possibility of a loss, the property manager must decide whether it is better to avoid risk by removing the source of risk. For instance, a swimming pool may pose an unacceptable risk if a daycare center is located in the building. Control risk by preparing for an emergency before it happens, example, by installing sprinklers, fire doors, and security systems. Transfer risk by shifting the risk onto another party, that is, by taking out an insurance policy. Retain risk by deciding that the chances of the event occurring are too small to justify the expense of any other response. An alternative might be to take out an insurance policy with a large deductible, which is usually considerably less expensive. Security of tenants. The physical safety of tenants of the leased premises is an important issue for property managers and owners. Recent court decisions in several parts of the country have held owners and their agents responsible for physical harm that was inflicted on tenants by intruders. These decisions have prompted property managers and owners to think about how to protect tenants and secure apartments from intruders. Types of insurance. Insurance is one way to protect against losses. Many types of insurance are available. An insurance audit should be performed by a competent, reliable insurance agent who is familiar with insurance issues for the type of property involved. The audit will indicate areas in which greater or lesser coverage is recommended and will highlight particular risks. Some common types of coverage available to income property owners and managers include the following. Fire and hazard. Fire insurance policies provide coverage against direct loss or damage to property from a fire on the premises. Standard fire coverage can be extended to include other hazards such as windstorm, hail, smoke damage, or civil insurrection. Consequential loss, use, and occupancy. Consequential loss insurance covers the results, or consequences, of a disaster. Consequential loss can include the loss of rent or revenue to a business that occurs if the business's property cannot be used. Contents and personal property. This type of insurance covers building contents and personal property during periods when they are not actually located on the business premises. Liability. Public liability insurance covers the risks an owner assumes whenever the public enters the building. A claim paid under this coverage is used for medical expenses by a person who is injured in the building as a result of the owner's negligence. Claims for those hurt in the course of their employment are covered by state laws known as Workers' Compensation Acts. A building owner who is an employer must obtain a workers' compensation policy from a private insurance company. Casualty. Casualty insurance policies include coverage against theft, burglary, vandalism, and machinery damage, as well as health and accident insurance. Casualty policies are usually written on specific risks, such as theft, rather than being all-inclusive. Surety bonds. Surety bonds cover an owner against financial losses resulting from an employee's criminal acts or negligence while performing assigned duties. Many insurance companies offer multi-peril policies for apartment and commercial buildings. Such a policy offers the property manager a package of standard commercial coverages, such as fire, hazard, public liability, and casualty. Special coverage for earthquakes and floods is also available. Insurance for the personal property of tenants is also available to tenants. Many tenants do not realize that if a property burns, their personal property is usually not covered by the landlord's policy. In Illinois, the policy type tenants should ask for is HO4, designed specifically to cover renters' personal property. Claims. Two possible methods can be used to determine the amount of a claim under an insurance policy. One is the depreciated, or actual, cash value of the damaged property. That is, the property is not insured for what it would cost to replace it, but rather for what it was originally worth, less the depreciation in value that results from use and the passage of time. The other method is current replacement cost. In this sort of policy, the building or property is insured for what it would cost to rebuild or replace it today. As with homeowners' policies, commercial policies include coinsurance clauses that require the insured to carry fire coverage, usually in an amount equal to 80% of a building's replacement value. If the coinsured amount is met on a policy guaranteeing replacement cost, it may mean that if a property is destroyed, the insured can collect more than the stated appraised value on the property. Leases. Leasing real estate. A lease is a contract between an owner of real estate, the lessor, and a tenant, the lessee. It is a contract to transfer the lessor's rights to exclusive possession and use of the property to the tenant for a specified period of time. The landlord receives payment for use of the premises and retains a reversionary right to possession after the lease term expires. The lessor's interest is called a leased fee estate plus reversionary right. The statute of frauds in Illinois requires that lease agreements be in writing to be enforceable if they are for more than 1 year. The written rule also applies to leases for 1 year or less that will not be performed within 1 year of the contract date. Verbal leases for 1 year or less that can be performed within a year of their making are enforceable. Written leases should be signed by both lessor and lessee. Leasehold estates. A tenant's right to possess real estate for the term of the lease is called a leasehold, less than freehold, estate. A leasehold is generally considered personal property. Just as there are several types of freehold, ownership, estates, there are different kinds of leasehold estates. Estate for years. And estate, tenancy, for years is a leasehold estate that continues for a definite period of time. That period may be years, months, weeks, or even days. And estate for years, sometimes referred to as fixed-term tenancy, always has specific beginning and ending dates. When the estate expires, the lessee is required to vacate the premises and surrender possession to the lessor. No notice is required to terminate the estate for years because the lease agreement states a specific expiration date. When the expiration date comes, the lease expires, and the tenant's rights are extinguished. As is characteristic of all leases, a tenancy for years gives the lessee the right to occupy and use the leased property according to the terms and covenants contained in the lease agreement. It must be remembered that a lessee has the right to use the premises for the entire lease term. That right is unaffected by the original lessor's death or sale of the property unless the lease states otherwise. If the original lease provides for an option to renew, no further negotiation is required. The tenant merely exercises his option. Tenancy for years equals any definite period estate from period to period. And estate from period to period, or periodic tenancy, is created when the landlord and tenant enter into an agreement for an indefinite time. That is, the lease does not contain a specific expiration date. A periodic tenancy is characterized by continuity because it is automatically renewable when rent is paid, under the original terms of the agreement until one of the parties gives notice to terminate. In effect, the payment and acceptance of rent extend the lease for another period. Periodic tenancy equals indefinite term, automatically renewing periodic tenancy. After estate for years tenancy expires, an estate from period to period also might be created when a tenant with an estate for years remains in possession or holds over after the lease term expires. If no new lease agreement has been made, a holdover tenancy is created. The landlord's acceptance of rent usually is considered conclusive proof of acceptance of the periodic holdover tenancy. The courts customarily rule that a tenant who holds over can do so for a term equal to the term of the original lease, provided the period is for 1 year or less. For example, a tenant with a lease for 6 months would be entitled to a new 6-month tenancy. However, if the original lease were for 5 years, the holdover tenancy could not exceed 1 year. To avoid this situation, landlords include in their leases language which states that if this type of holdover tenancy should occur, that the tenancy is converted to a month-to-month periodic tenancy, which can then be canceled with a 30-day notice. In Illinois, a holdover tenancy is for the same term as the estate from period to period. To terminate a periodic estate, either the landlord or the tenant must give proper notice. Normally, the notice must be given 1 period in advance. The following notices are required by Illinois statute. Tenancy from year to year, at least 60 days. Written notice is required at any time within the 4-month period prior to the last 60 days of the lease period. Tenancy from month to month, in any periodic estate having a term of less than year to year but greater than week to week, 30 days, written notice is required. Tenancy from week to week, 7 days, written notice is required. Farm tenancies from year to year parties must give at least 4 months written notice to terminate, and may do so only at the end of the period. To vacate March 1st, farm tenancy notice must be given by November 1st. Estate at will. And estate, tenancy. At will gives the tenant the right to possess property with the landlord's consent for an unspecified or uncertain term. And estate at will is a tenancy of indefinite duration. It continues until it is terminated by either party giving proper notice. And estate at will is automatically terminated by the death of either the landlord or the tenant. During the existence of a tenancy at will, the tenant has all the rights and obligations of a lessor-lessee relationship, including the duty to pay rent at regular intervals. Estate at sufferance. And estate, tenancy. At sufferance arises when a tenant who lawfully possessed real property continues in possession of the premises without the landlord's consent after the rights expire. This estate can arise when a tenant for years fails to surrender possession at the lease's expiration and continues until the landlord completes the eviction process. When a tenant is in breach of the lease, a tenancy at sufferance also can occur by operation of law. A landlord has the option of considering an estate at sufferance, a holdover tenant's action, as being a willful withholding of possession, in which case the landlord is entitled to charge double rent. Types of leases. Gross lease. In a gross lease, the tenant pays a fixed rent, and the landlord pays all taxes, insurance, repairs, utilities, and the like connected with the property, usually called property charges or operating expenses. This is typically the type of rent structure involved in apartment rentals. Net lease. In a net lease, the tenant pays all or some of the property charges in addition to the base rent. The monthly base rental is net income for the landlord after operating costs have been paid. Leases for entire commercial or industrial buildings and the land on which they are located, ground leases, and long-term leases, are usually net leases. In a triple net lease or net-net-net lease, the tenant pays all operating and other expenses in addition to rent. These expenses include CAM, common area maintenance and operating expenses, taxes, real estate taxes, insurance, building, liability, and other insurance costs, percentage lease. Either a gross lease or a net lease may be a percentage lease. The rent is based on a minimum fixed base monthly rental fee plus a percentage of the annual gross income received by the tenant doing business on the leased property. This type of lease is usually used for retail businesses and restaurants. The percentage charged is negotiable and varies depending on the nature of the business, the location of the property, and general economic conditions. Variable lease. Several types of leases allow for increases in the rental charges during the lease periods. One of the more common is the graduated lease, which provides for specified rent increases at set future dates. Another is the index lease, which allows rent to be increased or decreased periodically, based on changes in the consumer price index or some other indicator. Ground lease. When a landowner leases unimproved land to a tenant who agrees to erect a building on the land, the lease is usually referred to as a ground lease. Ground leases usually involve separate ownership of the land and buildings. These leases must be for a long enough term to make the transaction desirable to the tenant investing in the building, and often run for terms of 50 years up to 99 years. Ground leases are generally net leases. The lessee must pay rent on the ground as well as real estate taxes, insurance, upkeep, and repairs. Oil and gas lease. When an oil company leases land to explore for oil and gas, a special lease agreement must be negotiated. Usually, the landowner receives a cash payment for executing the lease. If no well is drilled within the period stated in the lease expires. However, most oil and gas leases permit the oil company to continue its rights for another year by paying another flat rental fee. Such rentals may be paid annually until a well is produced. If oil or gas is found, the landowner usually receives a percentage of its value as a royalty. As long as oil or gas is obtained in significant quantities, the lease continues indefinitely. Lease with option to purchase. A lease with option to purchase is used when a tenant wants to purchase the property but is unable to do so. Perhaps the tenant cannot obtain favorable financing or clear title, or the tax consequences of a current purchase would be unfavorable. In this arrangement, the purchase agreement is the primary consideration, and the lease is secondary. Part of the periodic rent is applied toward the purchase price of the property until that price is reduced to an amount for which the tenant can obtain financing or purchase the property outright, depending on the terms of the lease purchase agreement. Sale and leaseback. A sale and leaseback is the arrangement whereby the owners of property sell the property and then lease it back again for an agreed period. And rental. A sale and leaseback is often used when extra capital is needed on a construction project. The original owners pull out their equity to use on other projects and reduce their taxable income when they pay rent to the new owner. The new owner now has a reliable source of rental income for an extended time. Additionally, a lease is handled differently than an asset in relation to a firm's balance sheet, so there may be some accounting advantages. Lease agreements. Requirements of a valid lease. A lease is a form of contract. To be valid, a lease must meet essentially the same requirements as any other contract. Capacity to contract. The parties must have the legal capacity to contract. Legal objectives. The objectives of the lease must be legal. Offer and acceptance. The parties must reach a mutual agreement on all the terms of the contract. Consideration. The lease must be supported by valid consideration. Rent is the normal consideration given for the right to occupy the leased premises. However, the payment of rent is not essential as long as consideration was granted in creating the lease itself. Sometimes, for instance, this consideration is labor performed on the property. The leased premises should be clearly described. If the lease is for a part of a building, such as an apartment, the space itself or the apartment designation should be described specifically. If supplemental space is to be included, the lease should clearly identify it. The elements of a valid lease can be remembered by the acronym CLOAC. Capacity. Legal objective. Offer and acceptance and consideration. Possession of premises. The lessor, as the owner of the real estate, is usually bound by the implied covenant of quiet enjoyment. The covenant of quiet enjoyment is a presumed promise by the lessor that the lessee may take possession of the premises. The landlord further guarantees that he will not interfere in the tenant's possession or use of the property. The lease may allow the landlord to enter the property to perform maintenance, to make repairs, or for other stated purposes. The tenant's permission is usually required. Use of premises. A lessor may restrict a lessee's use of the premises through provisions included in the lease. Use restrictions are particularly common in leases for stores or commercial space. For example, a lease may provide that the leased premises are to be used only as a real estate office and for no other purpose. In the absence of such clear limitations, a lessee may use the premises for any lawful purpose. Term of lease. The term of a lease is the period for which the lease will run. It should be stated precisely, including the beginning and ending dates, together with a statement of the total period of the lease. For instance, a lease might run for a term of 30 years beginning June 1, 2011 and ending May 31, 2041. A perpetual lease for an inordinate amount of time or an indefinite term usually will be ruled invalid. Implied warranty of habitability. The Illinois Supreme Court first confirmed the concept of an implied warranty of habitability in residential tenancies in 1972. Since then, Illinois courts have repeatedly confirmed and amplified the warranty. A landlord must deliver and maintain throughout the duration of the lease any residential leasehold free from defects that would render the use of the dwelling unsafe or unsanitary and unfit for human occupancy. Nothing may be present on the premises that could seriously endanger the life, health, or safety of the tenant. The conditions that violate the implied warranty of habitability vary depending on the state and jurisdiction where the premises are located. Generally, a landlord can be in violation by failing to provide access to drinkable water and hot water. Heat during cold weather. Working electricity. A smoke detector. A working bathroom and toilet. Removal of rodent or insect infestation, or building code violations. A tenant must give the landlord notice of a defect and reasonable time in which to cure it. As a remedy, the tenant may choose to move out and terminate the lease if repairs are not made within a reasonable time. Constructive eviction. Stay and repair the problem himself and deduct the repair costs from the next month's rent. Repair costs cannot exceed 1 month's rent, or sue for any damages resulting from the defective condition security deposit. Most leases require that the tenant provide some form of security deposit to be held by the landlord during the lease term. However, with the paperwork involved in maintaining escrow accounts and interest payment reports, many landlords are opting to charge only a move-in fee. If the tenant defaults on payment of rent or destroys the premises, the lessor may keep all or part of the deposit to compensate for the loss. Illinois lessees are entitled to receive annual interest on their security deposits. Landlords who receive security deposits on residential leases of units in properties of 25 or more units, on deposits held for more than 6 months, are required to pay interest from the date of the deposit at a rate equal to the interest paid on a minimum deposit passbook savings account of the state's largest commercial bank, measured by total assets, with its main banking facilities located in Illinois. Any landlord who is found by a court to have willfully withheld interest on a tenant's security deposit must pay the tenant an amount equal to the security deposit plus the tenant's court costs and attorney's fees. Note: Chicago security deposit rules and rates for residential landlords differ under the Chicago Residential Landlord and Tenant Ordinance. Improvements. Neither the landlord nor the tenant is required to make any improvements to the leased property. The tenant may, however, make improvements with the landlord's permission. In most residential properties, any alterations become the property of the landlord, allowance for the wear and tear of normal use. Assignment and subleasing. When a tenant transfers all of his leasehold interests to another person, the lease has been assigned. The new tenant is legally obligated for all the promises the original tenant made in the lease. On the other hand, when a tenant transfers less than all the leasehold interests by leasing them to a new tenant, the original tenant has subleased or sublet the property. The original tenant remains responsible for rent being paid by the new tenant and for any damage done to the rental during the lease term. The new tenant is responsible only to the original tenant to pay the rent due. Assignment and subleasing are only allowed when a lease specifically permits them. In both assignments and subleases, details of the new arrangement should be in writing. Most leases prohibit a lessee from assigning or subletting without the lessor's consent. This permits the lessor to retain control over the occupancy of the leased premises. As a rule, the lessor must not unreasonably withhold consent. The sublessor's, original lessee's, interest in the real estate is known as a sandwich lease. Recording a lease. Anyone who inspects the property receives actual notice. For these reasons, it is usually considered unnecessary to record a lease. However, most states do allow a lease to be recorded in the county in which the property is located. Some states require that long-term leases be recorded, especially when the lessee intends to mortgage the leasehold interest, usually for a lease more than 20 years. Non-disturbance clause. A non-disturbance clause is a mortgage clause stating that the mortgagee agrees not to terminate the tenancies of lessees who pay their rent, should the mortgagee foreclose on the mortgagor lessor's building. Options. A lease may contain an option that grants the lessee the privilege of renewing the lease, called a renewal option. The lessee must, however, give notice of his intention to exercise the option. Some leases grant the lessee the option to purchase the leased premises, called a purchase option. The lease might also contain a right of first refusal clause, allowing the tenant the opportunity to buy the property before the owner accepts an offer from another party.